The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. And welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Ira Brind, and I've been affiliated with the library for a number of years and realize the important role it plays in not only promoting literacy, but also because it serves as a place for the community to gather and discuss topics that affect their lives. In fact, the Central Library has hosted several lectures on holistic healthcare in conjunction with the Myrna Brind Center for Integrative Medicine at Jefferson University, which my late wife and I founded. This evening, it is my pleasure to introduce Nobel laureate Dr. Eric Kandel. Before we get started, please take a moment and turn off your cell phones. Just do it now, because we often forget. And be sure to join us after the lecture for the book signing in the lobby. Also, no flash photography, please. Dr. Kandel was born in Vienna, Austria, and immigrated with his family to the United States in 1939. He graduated from Harvard and received his MD from New York University School of Medicine. Following a psychiatry residence at Harvard, Dr. Kandel spent 14 months working with Ladislav Tocque at the Institut Moret in Paris. It was there that Dr. Kandel learned how to stimulate memory in neurons from sea slugs, which he would later apply to show, for the first time, the intricate biological process by which the brain creates short and long-term memories from sensations. Dr. Kandel's research has been pivotal in relating three psychologically defined forms of learning to subcellular processes and intercellular signaling. In his studies, Dr. Kandel found that simple behaviors could be accounted for by distinctive sets of nerve cells, and with colleagues found that learning produces changes in behavior not by altering basic circuitry, but by adjusting the strength of particular connections between nerve cells. More recently, Dr. Kandel's lab has extended this approach from simple forms of memory in the sea slugs to more complex forms of spatial learning in mammals. He has been recognized for his groundbreaking research through many prestigious appointments and awards. He held faculty positions at Harvard, NYU School of Medicine before heading to Columbia, where he was the founding director of the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior, and is currently Kavli Professor and University Professor and the Senior Investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and accounts among his honors the Wolf Prize, the National Medal of Science, and the 2000 Nobel Prize in Physiology of Medicine. His memoir is a skillful and artistic blend of biography and history, as well as modern biology and behavior. It takes the reader through his intellectual journey from his very first vivid memories of Kristallnacht to his initial fascination with psychoanalysis, to his recent and current work on the biological process of memory. It's an honor to have him here tonight. Please welcome Dr. Eric Kandel to the Free Library.
Thank you very much. Excuse me. Thank you, Ira, for that gracious introduction. I'm delighted to be here in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, and to have a chance to chat with you this evening about my book. In this book, I try to bring together two themes. One, my own personal life, and two, more importantly, the emergence during my life, and certainly during my scientific career, of a new biological approach to mind as a result of the bringing together of various sub-disciplines that were concerned with aspects of mental function, disciplines like psychology, neuroscience, molecular biology, and imaging. These have given rise to a much deeper insight into mental functioning and an appreciation that all mental processes derive from the brain. Let me begin with my own personal odyssey and then tell you a little bit about my own work and how I was able to participate in and to observe this enormous movement that occurred during my lifetime as a result of the efforts of literally hundreds of scientists throughout the world, thousands of scientists throughout the world. I had a very modest beginning. There was no reason to think that I would have an academic career or to have a life in science. In fact, that was farthest from my thought. And my early years were primarily devoted with overcoming the traumata of the incidents that surrounded my years in Vienna. I was born in Vienna, November 7th, 1929, to a lower middle class family, my parents, who owned a small toy store in Vienna on Kutschkegasse. They had a very modest existence and we had a very pleasant life. I was the younger of two children. My brother Louis was 5 years older than myself. And everything was reasonably comfortable until March 13th, 1938, when Hitler marched into Austria. To everyone's surprise, when that occurred, the Austrians, who one had thought were opposed to Hitler, all of a sudden welcomed him with open arms. He crossed the border into Linz and was received by a wild crowd enthusiastically as the hero who unified the German-speaking countries. He came to Vienna. The Cardinal of Vienna, Cardinal Initzer, saluted him and spoke of him as the savior. And he spoke to a group of 400,000 enthusiastic Viennese on the Heldenplatz. My brother and I listened to this on a little crystal set that my brother, who was very inventive, had built. And we were both hypnotized and frightened by it. That outburst of enthusiasm, of welcome, turned within 24 hours into a brutal attack on Jews. Jews were asked to use whatever means available, including toothbrushes and hand brushes, to clean the streets of Vienna. Their stores were plundered, they were beaten up, they were embarrassed. It was an unbelievable experience. Karl Zuckmayer, a German dramatist who had fled to Austria, to Vienna in 1933 when Hitler came to power, described this in his autobiography. He said in his autobiography, "I've experienced some of the most horrible events of the first decades of the century. I fought in the First World War. I saw colleagues killed right next to me. I saw gassings at the front. I saw unbelievable, painful events during the war. I was in Munich during the first Hitler putsch in 1922. I was in Berlin when Hitler came to power in 1932. Nothing compared in its brutality to the actions of the Austrian Nazis. Even the German Nazis who were there said they were just amazed at the outrageousness of these people. This affected me in a modest way. I was walking along Kutschkegasse one day, maybe 2 days after Hitler came in. A classmate bumped into me and he said, "Kandel, my father said I'm never to speak to you again." No one in my class spoke to me. Within 4 or 5 weeks, we were kicked out of school, and all the Jewish students were sent to a special school outside of the main part of Vienna. I was beaten up when I went to the park. I was humiliated whenever possible. But all this was relatively bearable until Kristallnacht, which was November 9th, 1938. Now, as some of you may remember, what happened in that time was that a young Jewish boy, 19 years of age, by the name of Herschel Greenspan, living in Paris, was extremely upset because his parents had been uprooted by the Nazis in Germany. He became crazed, charged into the German embassy in Paris, and shot Ernst von Rath, an embassy official there. In response to this killing, Hitler and Goering unleashed the most extraordinary attack of anti-Semitism probably that Europe has ever experienced. Every single synagogue, with rare exception, in Germany and Austria was destroyed, including mine in Schopenhauergasse. My birthday was November 7th. I had received from my father a toy car, a blue toy car with remote control that I ran around our little apartment for a day and a half. On the 9th of November, there was a knock on the door. Two Nazi policemen came in and said, "You've got 20 minutes, pack your belongings. You're going to have to stay with another Jewish family whose address we will give you." We got, my brother, my mother and I were together. We got a few things together and we went and we stayed with this family whom we had never met before. They were more affluent than we. They had a very nice apartment, but they were as uncomfortable as we were about what was happening. We felt awkward about imposing upon them, and even though they were very gracious, they were very frightened. We were particularly frightened because we didn't know what happened to my father, whom we had not seen since that morning. We stayed with this family for about a week, and then were told we could go back to our apartment. When we came back to the apartment, everything of value was gone, including this little toy car. My mother's fur coat was gone. Silverware was gone, a couple of my father's suits. I mean, everything that you could possibly value was gone. We'd realized for some time that we needed to get out, and fortunately we had a relative in the United States, my mother's brother, who sent us an affidavit that allowed us to come to the United States. And we left in stages, so my grandparents, whose son it was who was in the United States, came first. They left in February 1939. My brother and I left in April 1939. And my parents, my mother and father, left in September 1939, just days before the war broke out. It's really interesting. I remember very vividly the ship that we came over and remember very well crossing the Atlantic. Now, this is a 9-year-old boy with a 14-year-old brother taking care of him, crossing the Atlantic by themselves. Now, I have grandchildren that age. I'm worried when they cross the street by themselves. It's really amazing how circumstances affect how one functions in a certain periods. When I was writing the book, I remembered vividly that the name of the ship we were on was called the Geraldstein, the SSS Geraldstein, Holland-American Line. I Googled the Holland-American Line, and they listed all their ships, but they didn't list the Geraldstein. But I felt so confident about my choice that I spelled it out in the book. About 2 months ago, my son, somehow or other, came across in the internet the list of 39 passengers on the Geraldstein. Bruno Bettelheim was on that ship together with me. Isn't that amazing? Another psychiatrist. And there it was, Eric Kandel-Erich, which my German spelling, 9 years old, Jewish origin, and Ludwig, my brother, 14 years old. I should also tell you, although I wasn't made aware of it much, much later, that in Kristallnacht, my father's store was taken away from him. We had no income after that. And since my family was of modest means, they ran out of their resources very early. And we were impoverished. And my father, as I found out really only about 2 or 3 years ago, went to the Israelitische Kultusgemeinde der Stadt Wien, the social service, Jewish social service agency of Vienna, which was a cohesive force that brought the Jewish community together, and asked them for help. And we received documentation a few years ago from the Kultusgemeinde, which shows Hermann Kandel, a member in good standing, has paid 5 shillings a year from the time he was married till now, comes to us impoverished. He's lost his store in Kristallnacht, and we are helping him, and he's moving furniture around to earn some money. He now comes to us in April and asks for 1.5 tickets on the Holland American line for his children to come to the United States. We look at his records, we see that he has no resources, we give him that. Later, there's an entry saying they've applied for 2 tickets for themselves. The ticket they have, by the way, is half is me because I'm a very young kid. The other is for my brother. They apply for 2 tickets for themselves, and they're granted that. So the Israelitische Kultusgemeinde Wien really saved my life. I came to the United States, and my grandparents had preceded me before me, and of course there was my uncle and my aunt was here. And I went to a public school in Brooklyn. I lived in 1119 Coney Island Avenue. There was a public school, PS 217, nearby, and I went there. And it was, I think, a perfectly reasonable school. And it was, as I later appreciated, a mixed neighborhood with a number of Jewish families, but I was extremely uncomfortable in that school. I looked around me, and there were lots of kids that were blonde and blue-eyed, and in Vienna that meant not Jewish. And I thought this was a class made up almost exclusively of non-Jews, and they were very much like a Viennese class, and they would turn on me. So I was quite uncomfortable. My grandfather, who was a wonderful man, and we had a very good friendship, and he was a very scholarly guy. In fact, my brother once said of him, he's the only man he knows who could speak 7 languages and couldn't make himself understood in any one of them. I don't think he sensed how frightened I was, but he said to me, you know, Eric, there is a wonderful yeshiva, a Hebrew parochial school, right nearby, and I know the principal, Mr. Braverman, and if you allow me to tutor you in Hebrew over the summer, I think you can get a scholarship there. So I had no interest in going to the yeshiva. I had less interest in learning Hebrew. I was extremely eager to get out of PS 217. So I agreed, and I went to the yeshiva Flatbush and had a very nice experience there. I should tell you that Baruch Blumberg, a Nobel laureate, also went to the yeshiva Flatbush. So this small school, you know, did all right for itself in that one category. They didn't have a high school in those days, so when I graduated in 1944, I went to Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn, and that was like a transforming experience for me. I was at Erasmus Hall High School. At the yeshiva, I was a scholarship student. At Erasmus, I was an athlete scholar. I know it's hard to believe. I find it hard to believe myself. But, you know, when you come to America, the thing you want to do is to be an American. This is a fantastic country, not just in Philadelphia, even in Brooklyn. And you really want to be an American. What does an American kid mean? You know, stickball, basketball. I was poor at all of those things. But one thing you learn as a Viennese Jew is to run. And I found to my amazement that I was a very good runner. I was fast, and I became, my psychiatry friends will be astonished. I was co-captain of the Erasmus Hall track team. We won, I should tell you, at the Penn Relays in the 1 mile. We also won at the Seton Hall Relays. So I had a wonderful high school experience. I was a reasonably good student. I was an athlete, and I got to know girls, all of three pleasant activities. And as I was about to graduate, my history teacher came up to me. And I should point out that when I came to America, one of the things that fascinated me is how could the Austrians act like this? You know, how could people, you know, read Goethe and Schiller? How could they listen to Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven one day and kill Jews the next? I mean, how do you explain this? Cultured, civilized people who have libraries like this act brutally the next day. And I tried to understand this in historical terms, and I was quite good in history. So Mr. Campana, the history teacher, approached me and said, "Eric, where are you going to college?" And I said, "I'm going to Brooklyn College. That's where I've applied to." He said, "Wait, where did you apply?" "My brother is going. That's a very good school." He said, "Have you ever thought of applying to Harvard?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, why don't you apply to Harvard?" And I said, "I'll discuss this with my parents." And I went home and I discussed it with my parents. And my father said, "Look, we've already spent $10 to send an application to Brooklyn College. We don't have a lot of money." My father at that time had no longer had a toy store. In America, he had a haberdashery store. I don't know whether this is moving up or moving down, but anyway, he had a haberdashery store. And so he said, "You know, Brooklyn College is a very good school. Lewis is getting a very good education, so that's fine." So I went back to Mr. Campana, and Mr. Campana said, "Look, let me put out the money, apply to Harvard." And I was one of two people from a class of about 1,140 that got accepted at Harvard with a scholarship. And Harvard was another unbelievable experience for me. And I owe that to Mr. Campana. The reason I point this out is, as must be true in all of your lives, there were individual incidents, and they were certainly enriched in America because this didn't occur with me that much in Vienna, in which people extended themselves to you at certain points in your life that made an enormous difference. I actually feel a bit that way toward Mickey Stunkett, who was, when he was chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, was extremely supportive of me and of my science. A number of other people also helped me. Campana was first the great helper that I had, after maybe Mr. Braverman, who took me into the yeshiva. I went to Harvard with the idea of doing intellectual history. I wanted to continue to understand what happened in Germany and Austria. How could people be transformed so rapidly in such a horrible way? And I majored in a field called history and literature, which is an honors field. You have to commit yourself to do a dissertation. And I wrote my dissertation on the attitude toward National Socialism of three German writers, Carossa, Zuckmayer, and Junger, who had different positions on the political spectrum. Zuckmayer is the guy I told you about. He was a liberal, a progressive, who got out of Vienna and came to the United States. Carossa was an internist, a physician, who took inner emigration, which meant he did nothing. He was against Hitler, but he didn't leave. His body stayed in Germany, but his soul, he claimed, was elsewhere. And Junger was sort of a proto-fascist. He thought war was a rejuvenating experience, and although he was not a Nazi, he was an intellectual precursor of the Nazis. And I wrote my dissertation. I was starting to work on my dissertation very seriously, and I fell in love. Who's to account for things like this? And I fell in love with a wonderful Viennese woman who is still a very good friend of mine. We just communicated by email the other day, Anna Chris, who is the daughter of Mariana and Ernst Chris, two psychoanalysts from the Freud Circle. Really fantastic people. Do you know the Mickey by any chance? They're really fantastic people. And I didn't just fall in love with her. I fell in love with them, and worse, they fell in love with me, which is not a good way to start a relationship. Ernst Chris, who was a fantastic intellectual, he actually, before he became an analyst, had been a curator at the Kunsthistorische Museum in Vienna. So he was a major art historian. And he wrote a very famous book called Psychoanalytic Explorations of Art. And he said to me, "You know, what's a nice Jewish boy like you doing, going intellectual history. I mean, you know, anybody can do that. You want to understand how the human mind works, you have to understand unconscious mental processes. You've got to really dig deep and, you know, read some Freud. I had read The Psychopathology of Everyday Life. I mean, I realized that Freud was a great thinker, a great stylist, but I began to read him more seriously and I realized this is really pretty interesting stuff. Now, many of you in the audience are probably too young to realize, but in 1950, when this was, psychoanalysis was the nouvelle vague. It was the most, interesting, far-out way of thinking about the human mind. Really, a number of the outstanding intellectuals of the time, whether within or without medicine, were using analytic insights to understand art, to understand literature, to understand drama, to understand human behavior. And I began to think that maybe this is for me. And so in order to become an analyst in those days, most people went to medical school. I had never taken a science course. I had no interest in science. And all of a sudden, at the spur of the moment, in the summer between my junior and senior year, I went to Harvard Summer School, and I took Chemistry 1. Nothing could be more boring. But I got through it in one piece, and based on that one course and my record in other subjects, I was accepted at NYU Medical School on the proviso. It's hard to believe it wouldn't happen nowadays. On the proviso that I take the remaining three requirements before I enter medical school. So I took physics and biology in my senior year, and I took organic chemistry in the summer between my senior year and starting medical school. I started medical school with the idea of becoming an analyst. I worked at Central Islip one summer. I worked at McLean one summer. I knew more about psychiatry by the time I entered my senior year than most of the faculty. This is not saying very much. If you know my opinion of the psychiatric community as a whole, with rare exceptions. So in my senior year, I was exposed to the opportunity. I was given the opportunity to take a 6-month elective period where you could do whatever you wanted to. And I didn't know what to do, so I thought a little bit about it. And I said, you know, even a psychoanalyst, a Park Avenue psychoanalyst, should know something about the brain. So I thought maybe I would take it. It's hilarious. There was a moderately radical idea. At that time, neuroscience was a very small field. There was nobody at NYU Medical School doing anything in neuroscience. Hard to believe. There was a guy at Columbia called Harry Grundfest, a very good guy, and I wrote to him, and he accepted me, and I took my 6-month elective period with him. And when I showed up in his lab, he said to me, now, what is it that you like to do? And I said, I don't really know. But, you know, it would be nice if one could localize in the brain where the ego, the id, and the superego are located. Now, he looked at me as if I was completely meshuggah. And he said, look, Bubby, he said, we don't know whether those areas... we don't know whether those constructs have any meaning. And even if they did, we don't have the tools for localizing them. I find that the best way to study the brain is one cell at a time. And I said, oi, one cell at a time. This is going to take a long time. And I began to do this, and he suggested at one point that I work on crayfish because one can put needles into these cells very well. And he taught me how to make recording instruments for recording from single cells. So it's a glass electrode, like a needle, that you put into the cell. And the first time I successfully put an electrode into the cell, and I heard boom, 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 these action potentials, a fantastic experience. I was recording from a single nerve cell. I was being a true crayfish psychoanalyst. I was listening to the inner fantasy life of this crayfish. His deepest thoughts. And I found this was so different than taking courses. Chem 1, oi, what a comparison. This was really interesting, you know, the sensuality of setting up an experiment, of doing this. It was really quite wonderful. So I had broken up with Anna Chris by that time, and I'd taken up with a new woman who I was to marry, Denise Bistrine, and we had dinner one night and at a restaurant. And I said to her, you know, I'm surprised. This is extremely enjoyable. I could consider doing this for a living, but it's completely impractical. You know, you don't have any money, and I don't have any money. I've got to go into private practice. And she said, absurd. Money is of no significance. She has not, I assured you, ever repeated those magic words to me. She said, my father, and he had died before I met her, my father said I should marry a poor intellectual because only that sort of a person would make a really useful contribution. Well, I certainly met the poverty criterion. So that really influenced my thinking. And as a result of that, I responded to Grundfist when he approached me at the end of my stay there. And he said, you know, how would you like me to nominate you for the National Institutes of Health? Now, that was a fantastic opportunity because when I graduated medical school in 1956, physicians were being drafted to take care of dependents and to take care of service people. And a very small percentage, less than 1%, that had done research and was suitable and selected by the NIH could do this as an alternative to service. It was called the Public Health Service. We called it draft dodgers, but in fact, you were in the service, and you could do science. And I said, that's wonderful. So he nominated me. I was selected by Wade Marshall, the head of the Laboratory of Neurophysiology at the National Institute of Mental Health. And I spent not the 2 required years, but I had such a good time, I spent an extra year there before starting my psychiatric residency. And the 3 years there transformed me. I came there incompetent, and I left a practicing scientist. When I got there, Marshall asked me, what is it that you want to do? Well, I'd gotten beyond the ego and superego. And I said, I don't really know. Let me think a little bit about this. And I read a little bit, and I told him, I'd like to study memory. Memory, I thought, is a wonderful problem. You know, first of all, it's central to psychoanalysis. We are who we are, in large part of what we learn, we remember. And psychoanalysis is an opportunity to relive earlier experiences in a trusting environment. And moreover, Brenda Milner, a fantastic psychologist who has become a very good friend of mine, a Canadian psychologist, working with Penfield, had discovered a patient called HM that some of you may have read about, who had lost a major class of memories, memories for people, places, and objects, the highest forms of memory in people. And he had a lesion that particularly involved a brain structure called the hippocampus. And so we knew that memory was importantly localized in the mammalian brain in the hippocampus. I knew how to put electrodes into cells. Most people at that time in neurobiology didn't know how to do that. So I thought maybe I would find out how the nerve cells of the hippocampus worked. I would solve memory in a very short period of time. And when I approached Marshall and some of the other people, they said, look, you know, you're here on your own time, you do whatever you want. We think this is too difficult. People have never recorded from that region. It pulsates, it's hard to get electrodes in there. And I was so ignorant and naive that I didn't pay any attention to that. Moreover, I was lucky soon after I got started, there was another draft dodger who came into Wade Marshall's lab. And I showed him what I was doing, and I told him what I was doing, and he got fascinated with the problem. Alden Spencer, who later became one of my closest friends, and we joined forces, and we worked on the hippocampus together. And within a month or two, we succeeded in getting electrodes into the hippocampus, and we heard the boom, boom, boom of action potentials in the hippocampus. No one in the world had ever done this. We were euphoric. We danced around the lab. We were just ecstatic. 2 incompetent kids had made a major advance in science. We were not the only ones. People were running up and down the hallway saying, did you see what Eric and Alden have found? I was asked to give a seminar to a room as packed as this to describe the findings that Alden and I had come up with. We got an enormous amount of recognition. We felt very good about ourselves until we suddenly asked ourselves, what did we learn about memory? We learned a lot about the cell biology of these cells, but they did not speak of memory to us. And we realized that memory is not just how a single cell responds. It's how information is transformed in the nervous system and altered as a result of experience. So you have to see how the information comes into the hippocampus. That turned out to be extremely difficult. And we tried with various ways, light stimuli, sound stimuli, tactile stimuli. We didn't get very far. So we decided, I was somewhat more radical than Alden in this approach, that we needed to take a much more reductionist approach to the study of memory. We needed to crawl before we walked and to walk before we run. And rather than beginning with the highest region of the brain and the most complicated form of memory, why don't we take the simplest form of memory? Why don't we take the simplest form of memory in the simplest animal and study it? So there the strategy changed completely. No longer working with a mammalian brain, we're working with a cat. But to see whether or not an animal had a very simple nervous system, that animal had behavior that could be modified by learning, and whether we could see what happens in the nervous system as the information comes in and is modified as a result of the learning experience. So I began to look around at NIH, all the good people were coming through, and since I was putting electrodes into cells, one of my key criterion was to have animals that have large cells, so it would be easy to put electrodes into cells. And I selected a plesiarc, a marine snail, because it had the largest nerve cells in the animal kingdom. Just to give you an example, when Alden Spencer and I recorded from the hippocampus, and this is why it was considered so difficult, if you could put this electrode into the cell for half an hour, it was a major accomplishment. We would sometimes go several weeks without a satisfactory recording. In aplysia, I mean, you'd have to be drunk or stupid not to get a successful recording. Moreover, you could put the electrode in, you could take a lunch break, and I mean a lunch break, with a glass of wine and come back and the electrode was still in the cell. And you'll see why wine is important in a moment. I also realized, in addition to large cells, the animal had very few cells. And it turned out that single behaviors could be controlled by 50 or 60 nerve cells. So it was really an amazing reduction. Only two people in the world were working on this marine snail aplysia, both of them French. This is why the wine is appropriate. One was working in Marseille, Angelique Avanitaki-Chalazonidis, and the other, Ladislav Torque in Paris. My wife is French, so far so good. Parisian. Parisian women are unbelievably chauvinistic. I mean, Paris. My comb comes from Paris. If it's French, it's got to be good. She said, Marseille, this is like going to Albany. Thank God she didn't say Philadelphia. So we went to Paris and we had a fantastic time with Ladislav Torque. And in the work with Torque really got me off the ground. And for the next, I don't know, 40 years, I've continued to work on the snail. And I just outlined briefly the work that initially I did by myself and then with colleagues I've carried out. In this simple animal, I was able to define a very, very simple behavior, a withdrawal reflex like the withdrawal of a hand from a hot object. I could work out that this simple reflex could be modified not by one, but by several different forms of learning. Habituation, sensitization, classical conditioning. These were the kinds of learning that Pavlov and Thorndike, the behaviorists, had described. Moreover, each of these forms of learning gave rise to both a short-term memory and a long-term memory depending upon number of repetitions. Practice makes perfect in snails as in people. So we were able to show that this simple reflex could undergo an amazing variety of learnings and undergo both short and long-term memory. Very nice. We then worked out the neural architecture of the reflex. the cells that control the behavior per se, the withdrawal response. We identified the sensory neurons, we identified the motor neurons, the interneurons, and we found they were invariant. The same exact cell that we could recognize, we could call it Mickey, Petra, Tim, the same cell we could recognize in every animal of the species. If it was a motor cell, it was the same motor cell. If it was a sensory cell, the same sensory cell. So the cells were invariant in every animal. Moreover, they connected to each other in a very precise way. The architecture was determined by genetic and developmental process. And that posed a paradox. How do you explain this capability for learning if the wiring diagram, the neural architecture, is so fixed? So we looked at what happens in the wiring diagram when the animal learns something. And we found that even though the existence of the connections is fixed, the strength of the connections is not. And we found that what learning does is change the strength of connections between cells, how one nerve cell communicates with each other. And this has turned out to be a general principle. Every form of learning that has been looked at involves an alteration in the strength of connections between nerve cells. Moreover, we showed that the same synaptic connection could be modulated in opposite directions by different forms of learning. So habituation, which is learning to ignore a trivial stimulus, causes a depression in the strength of communication between cells, while sensitization, a form of learned fear, causes a tremendous enhancement. So we were able to really sort of work out the physiology of the learning process in some detail. We also looked at short-term and long-term memory, and we found that short-term memory leads to a functional and reversible change in the strength of synaptic connections. But long-term memory leads to a persistent change that is associated with growth of new synapses. So if you remember anything about this lecture, I don't urge this on you, but if you remember it, it's because you'll have a different brain that you walked into this room with. Pretty nifty. Moreover, I have argued and work around Tim's efforts have shown that insofar as psychotherapy works, it produces an environment in which people can change, and that change can persist over time. One should ultimately be able to detect those anatomical changes with imaging. And using cognitive behavioral therapy, one has been able to do that. So Tim and I, although we only met a few years ago, have been conceptually overlapping and interacting for a very long period of time. When I came to Columbia, I turned my physiological efforts to the molecular level. I began to interact with a wonderful friend, who's a colleague who actually won the Nobel Prize 4 years after I did, Richard Axel, and we influenced each other enormously. He had never seen the brain before, and I'd never seen a molecule before. So I taught him about the brain, and he taught me about molecular biology. And the first thing I did, which actually before I met Richard, is to see what are the molecules involved. And we found that a particularly signaling system in the brain, called the cyclic AMP signaling system, is activated by learning. And with short-term memory, it gets activated very transiently. But with long-term memory, the signaling system moves into the nucleus, and it turns on genes. And it's the turning on of those genes that gives rise to the growth of new synaptic connections. Now, that was really a very interesting set of insights. And there are two things I want you to appreciate here. One is that one thinks of genes as being the controllers of behavior, the determinants of behavior. What we learned is that obviously is true, but genes are also the servants of the environment. They can be modified by the learning process. Now, some people get very nervous about this. You, who are holding this lady's hand, guys like you get very nervous about this process. Why? They say, look, I'm listening to this silly lecture. I go home and I make love with my partner and we have a baby. That poor baby has to know, remember, that silly lecture that I heard in the Free Library of Philadelphia? Terrible. Not to worry. You have my permission to do what you want tonight, all right? The genes that are being changed are changed in specific regions of the brain. They don't affect the sperm or the egg. They have nothing to do with what happens in later generations. Thank God. There are other interesting twists, but I won't bother telling you about it. We found, for example, there is a repressor that you have to overcome, an inhibitory constraint in memory. Now, at first you might say to yourself, isn't that silly? Don't you want to put everything into long-term memory? And the answer is no. Most things that happen to you are miserable. You want to forget them as soon as possible. So in order for it to be important, you have to really overcome it. And I was actually pleased when I got interested in the problem of memorists, because if you remove this restraint in flies or in aplysia, we've now shown this in a mouse, animals put things into long-term memory immediately. Everything they learn goes into long-term memory. And since my memory is not that great, I was delighted to learn when I studied up on memorists that they're quite miserable. They feel their head is filled with garbage. So it's really useful to have some space in the brain for other things. In around 1990, my colleagues and I opened up a second front. We began to work on mice, and we returned to the hippocampus. And this was made possible because two people, Capecchi and Smythes, including Brinster working here at the University of Pennsylvania, developed techniques for genetically modifying mice. And from that, you could see how you could genetically modify the brains of mice. You could insert genes, you could remove genes at will. And with this genetic approach in the mouse, it was clear to me, and also to Suzuma Tanigawa at MIT, that you could now approach learning and memory in a completely new level. By that time, one had learned a lot about the hippocampus, how information got in, and one learned in particular that the hippocampus of mice is very good for the remembrance of space. So we began to focus in on mice, and although the details differ, by and large, the same general principles hold. There's a short-term memory and a long-term memory. Long-term memory involves cyclic AMP moving into the nucleus, activating pretty much the same genes as in aplysia, removing a repressor, activating an activator, and giving rise to the growth of new synaptic connections. With that as a background, about 8 or 9 years ago, I began to get interested in disorders of memory. And recently, I've begun to explore that in a number of areas. The first thing I looked at is age-related memory loss. Let me put this into perspective for you. So if you take 100 people who are age 70, who are perfectly healthy people, no depression, no neurological disorders of any kind, who function well, have no cognitive impairments, and give them very sensitive tests for memory, you find that 40%, 40 people out of that 100, function like you do, like you did in your 20s and your 30s. 60% of people show a mild weakening in memory that can progress with time. In half of that, that is 30%, the progression is very mild, and that's called age-related memory loss or non-Alzheimer memory loss or benign senescent forgetfulness. It's a wonderful euphemism. It doesn't begin in senescence. It begins at age 40, and to people who have it, it isn't that benign, but it's a wonderful term. The other half go on to Alzheimer's disease, which is a fulminating and very unpleasant disease. Mice do not show spontaneous Alzheimer's disease. You can put an Alzheimer gene into them artificially, and they'll show Alzheimer's, but normally they don't show that. But they show age-related memory loss. We looked at their brains, and we saw that the cyclic AMP system is compromised. So it's a little bit like diabetes. If you give insulin, you can restore it. We found, to our amazement, that you could really restore completely age-related memory loss in the mouse. So as I have told people earlier this evening, if you're a mouse, we can do a lot for you. People we're not sure about. So a friend and I started a company called Memory Pharmaceuticals that is now trying various drugs based upon these strategies in people. It turns out that these drugs, this was not work done by me, by Mike Shalansky, also works in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. So let me conclude by sort of stepping back a little bit and seeing whether I can pull a few strands together. I think several things in my career stand out. One is that this is a fabulous place to do science in. I emphasize this particularly today because I'm not as certain that it's going to be that great in the future. This was clearly the 20th century was the American century of biology. American contributions were remarkable because we not only have an open society, a very democratic society, but scientists were by and large free to do what they wanted to, and they were very generously supported by private philanthropy, but even more by the government. And the government has not been supporting science that much recently. But in addition, I was very fortunate in the circumstances of my life. Once I came to the United States and overcame the unfortunate circumstances in Vienna, I had mentors who were extremely supportive, who were not competitive with me, but encouraged me on, gave me fantastic opportunities. I also was extremely fortunate in having a fantastic partner, my wife, who, even though she spends a lot of money, is a terrific human being. She doesn't spend that much money. And I've found it very fortunate to learn to trust myself. Now, you have to realize that I moved from one field to another, not having trained for that. I moved into medicine knowing nothing. I moved out of medicine and psychoanalysis into doing biological research in the brain, which I knew nothing. I moved into behavioral psychology. I moved into molecular biology. In each case, teaching myself, taking advantage of the colleagues around me, forming collaborations with people who knew much more than I did and who generously shared their knowledge with me. So I was not only very fortunate, but I learned to trust my instinct. In fact, one thing I really think is important is to learn to trust your unconscious. I sometimes go in some direction and people think I'm wandering off in left field. I'm sure all of you have had this experience. And I say, you know, you've been lost before. You always find your way out. Stare. You're going to find something interesting. There's got to be, you know, the story about the guy who was always optimistic, and one time his friends decided that for Christmas they're going to do something for his optimism. So they gave him a huge pile of manure for a Christmas present. And he walked into the room. He said, "Fantastic. With all this manure, there's got to be a pony someplace." So I've pretty much sort of followed that philosophy, looking for the pony. And at least in a number of occasions, I found a pony somewhere in that pile. Thank you very much.
Wow, that was wonderful. I'm not sure we want to allow you to stop, even if it is to ask questions. But we do have an opportunity now to ask Dr. Kandel questions. We have volunteers on each side with microphones, and I urge you to wait till we get the microphone to you. The first hand I saw was the gentleman right here on my right, and then we'll go into the middle, and then we'll move across. Okay.
Doctor, thank you very much. That was very enjoyable. Going back to the repressor mechanism, can you think of any connection between that and the evolutionary survival reason for that in lower forms of animals?
I missed the first word. The what mechanism?
The repressor.
The repressor
of memory.
It's a general principle of biology. You find it in control of gene expression in bacteria. You know, the lac repressor that was described in the control of viral life. Every excitatory process has to be restrained, otherwise it would run wild. Are you married, sir?
Here she is.
She sits on you to hold you back. There are inhibitory constraints built into life. Sherrington described reciprocal innovation. So you excite one pathway, you inhibit the opposing pathway. So it has the idea of limiting the excitatory drive, otherwise it would run away with it. But also it makes it hard to accomplish something. And many things require an absolute threshold. You don't want to put trivial information into long-term memory. So this is a requirement, and you find it in a variety of completely unrelated contexts in biology. It's an almost universal mechanism.
Okay, thank you. Right here, this gentleman, and then we'll move on back. Woman in the white, that sweater there.
I'd like to know what you think the great mysteries are that you see right now, in the brain and in memory research particularly?
There are many. So I tried to indicate in my book, and I want to emphasize to you, that even though my generation has made remarkable progress in understanding the brain, a lot of that is the demystification, you know, the taking out the huge mystery and the extra meaning that people associate with mental activity and placing it square into the brain. All mental activity comes from the brain. And we've made progress in almost all areas, including some progress into consciousness. But our understanding is limited. We're at the foothills of an enormous mountain range, and that mountain range needs to be scaled. So we know some aspects of perception, but we don't know how I perceive your face. We have some idea about the control of movement, about how sensory information leads to complex movements we don't understand. We don't understand higher processes, like how do you recall a memory? We understand how to store it, but we don't know how to recall it at a later time, except in the most simple circumstances, like a reflex. We don't know very much about attention. We're beginning to study it, but we don't know very much about it. We know nothing about consciousness. We know very little about mental illness. The biological underpinnings of schizophrenia, depression, have escaped us. We have a very primitive understanding of those things. Many neurological diseases we don't really understand well. Down syndrome, Alzheimer's disease, we understand a lot now about the molecular pathology, but the detailed mechanisms and how to treat it, we don't understand as yet. So I could go on and on. So we have very good beginnings in almost all areas, but it's a century of work ahead of us. Sociobiology, how people interact with each other, what are the biological processes involved in person-to-person communication. Moreover, the neurobiological community has the feeling that neuroscience may, in the limit, be the new Esperanto, the international language, because it deals with the biology of the human mind. This, after all, is the base of all the universities concerned with the nature of human existence. So it forms a bridge between philosophy and the sciences. You can't do philosophy of mind without being a neurobiologist. The mind is in the brain. The mind is a set of functions carried out by the brain. You can't do psychology without being a neurobiologist. Economics and neurobiology use common ways of analyzing prediction that people make when given with economic choices. In the law, we were discussing this at dinner, a number of legal experts have become interested in the application of neurobiology to law. The issue of free will. Are there any independent measures of free will? To what degree do you have free will? When is a subject lying? When is he telling the truth? These are the kinds of things that ultimately knowledge of the brain sciences could reveal. Not even touching on areas of neurology and psychiatry and medicine that derive from disorders of the brain. So hopefully, as the science matures, it will have an impact on all aspects of thought.
Next question is, keep your hand up and the gentleman will get to you. There we go.
Hello, I have two questions for you. The first is, my husband and I were wondering if you're related to Woody Allen.
I can assure you I'm not related to him financially.
Okay, as a segue to the financial question, you mentioned that you're fearful about the future of funding for research in this country. What do you see in the future, and have you talked to Bill and Melinda Gates lately?
I missed the last part of it. What do I see about the future and?
Have you talked to Bill and Melinda Gates lately?
Well, they are fantastic human beings. I mean, their contribution is enormous. And they represent a uniquely American strand of philanthropy and generosity focused on the public good and finding its expression in the medical sciences. I mean, the Rockefellers, the Gates, the Howard Hugheses, the Ellison Foundation, I mean, many wonderful foundations out there that are doing great good. But the problems of medical sciences, the problems of sciences in general, cannot simply be handled by philanthropy alone. The financial cost is enormous. And it is my feeling, obviously this is a conflict of interest because I'm a scientist, that you cannot have a great society without having great science. Science doesn't simply give you insight into the functioning of the universe. It is the engine that drives the economy. We are living, you know, in an internet era. That did not come out of the ether. That came out of bright people doing difficult experiments. Everywhere you look, you see that science has been important to the American economy. And I think in the last 6 years, we've lost sight of that. We've treated science as if it was a luxury of some sort. And I think that's unfortunate. And we've had world leadership in science because we're a great country and we realized that we want to educate the young and allow them to do what they want, and many of them went into science and have had wonderful careers. Now, a number of young people cannot continue their careers because they don't have adequate government support. So I think, I'm not saying this is irreversible, we're in a very serious crisis. And I think we need to take that seriously.
Please raise your hands. Let's take a question here, and then we'll move to the back, and then come over this way.
Dr. Kendall, you've had a lot of questions in your life and resolved many of them.
I should tell you, we could spend several weeks speaking those that are unresolved.
Well, that's what I was getting to. You started your career with a profound question, and I wondered if you had gotten any answers to that, and that is, how do good people and cultivated people turn in 24 hours into villains?
I mean, that is really one of the most profound questions, and I have to tell you that I don't have any great insight into it, and I certainly don't have any better insight than I did when I started addressing that question. There are many factors, obviously, that lead to that. The social circumstance, I think, in some ways, well, take Germany, for example. The difference between how we handled the situation in Germany after the First World War and after the Second World War is an issue of day and night. In the First World War, in the Treaty of Versailles, we created a situation in which Germany was so humiliated, so undercut financially and politically, that it was very hard for it to survive and very easy for demagogues to come to power. Whenever there's a crisis, people turn to radical solutions because people share one thing in common: they're easily frightened. In the Second World War, we treated Germany as losers. We asked them to make sure that they confront their horrible deeds, but we gave them an opportunity to rebuild their society on a democratic model. It's made an enormous difference. I don't know whether you've been in Germany. One really feels like a free person in Germany. I've had no difficulty in Germany. I have much more difficulty in Austria, where that policy was not quite followed. One allowed the Austrians to feel as if they had no role in it. They were victims. And when you look at the statistics, there were more Austrians per capita in concentration camps as guards, as leaders, etc. Eichmann was an Austrian. So, I mean, how the world community handles situations, I think, is very important. The other thing is, I mean, just looking at our own action in the last few years, you realize, and this is just looking around, the capability for evil is present in our genome. It is there. Good people, under societal pressures, can do horrible things. And it's the function of society, and this is, I think, why America has by and large been so remarkably successful, is to create an environment in which those kinds of activities are unacceptable. But even we've made mistakes. You know, we've had a racist society for, you know, until about 20 or 30 years ago, even, you know. And look, for example, women. One of the most amazing things, because the women in my family are really, you know, very independent and successful people, that was not the opportunity that was given to women 100 years ago. In fact, I must tell you something funny. In 1952, when I graduated from Harvard College, Harvard Law School admitted women for the first time. Can you imagine 1952, Harvard Law School, the leader of the country, admitted women to the law school for the first time. They didn't have ladies' rooms. The women used men's room at certain odd hours. So, I mean, there is absurdity built into human judgment. We're all flawed people. So I really think that some of this is intrinsic, and it's the function of a democratic, optimistic, and enlightened society to provide the criterion for a peaceful existence. And it's very, very hard. It's very, very hard. I just give you a trivial example. I'm sort of free associating here. I'm very much interested in the Israeli-Palestinian situation to bring peace between those two groups. And I've been part of a group of people that's been working with Elie Wiesel to bring the Palestinians and the Israelis together. And we were in Petra a year ago, and Wiesel was able to bring Abbas and Hamas, the leaders of the Ometz and Abbas, the leaders of Israel and Palestine together. And they promised to work for peace. 2 weeks later, you know, after they went home, this Israeli soldier was kidnapped, and boom, explosion control. So even leaders can't control societies. So this is a complex issue. And I think it cannot be solved on an individual basis because individuals just have so much capability for evil. It has to be solved on a society basis.
I had promised the gentleman in the back on the aisle there, or the right with his hand up now. Keep your hand up, please. Thank you.
Nice to be referred as a gentleman. You're a wonderful storyteller, and you have fascinating stories to tell. There's no more important subject than NIH funding, and we can spend a lot of time talking about that for its importance in our society. But on one note, you related work that you have done with a particular molecule, which looks in some preliminary studies you refer to that it may have an effect in early Alzheimer's. Can you elaborate upon that?
You want me to elaborate on the insights we have in the mechanisms that might reverse early Alzheimer's. Is that your question, sir?
You referred to some studies regarding that.
Yes, okay. So we found, this is actually quite interesting and refers to the question about inhibitory constraints that somebody asked, repressors. We found in our own work that the cyclic AMP pathway is compromised in age-related memory loss. And we reversed that with boosting up the cyclic AMP level. Michael Chelansky, a guy in Colombia, who was working completely independently of us on Alzheimer's disease, found that in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, the cyclic AMP pathway is compromised. Excuse me, but not because it's incapable of signaling, but because a number of inhibitory constraints are excessively recruited. So this repressor for gene activation is present in abundance. Something that sits on the signaling pathway is present in abundance. It is shut down. So the same drugs that increase cyclic AMP will work here because they're able to overcome this inhibitory barrier. And he's shown that in mice, this works very well. Now, whether these substances will work in people, we don't know as yet. There are early clinical trials in which my company is involved in testing that, but we don't have results as yet.
Let's have right here, and then we'll go back about two-thirds of the way.
Dr. Kendall, first of all, thank you very much for the permission you so graciously granted me, but my short-term and long-term memory tell me it's not yours to give. But anyway.
I told you to forget it.
Oh, okay.
I'm glad you followed my advice.
You said, I think, something to the effect that sort of our life, we are some combination of what our genetics are and our memory. That is what we remember, what we've learned.
Right.
So is there potential here through the study of memory and its formation and its use to teach people, to go back to Dr. Goodman's question, to teach people ethical behavior, to teach compassion, to teach other kinds of value-based things which will then become part of us in ways that they might not be now?
That's a very beautiful question. A lot of that goes on independent of knowing the biology of the brain. Just sort of sit back a little bit, okay? Think of how women are treated professionally now compared to how they were treated 50 years ago. That means there's a change in society that has occurred, an appreciation of the intellectual worth of half the population. Homosexuality. I mean, it was hidden, even though a significant number of the population is homosexual. I won't go into this, but I had an amazing incident with one of my colleagues who is a major, major, major scientist, a phenomenal, one of the most famous scientists in the world. And we were at a dinner party together, and he said, you know, I believe in gene changes. I mean, I'm bald. If my wife was pregnant with a child and we could do genetic testing and that child proved to be bald, I would abort it. We'd have a child that would not be bald. And he went on and on and on like that. He obviously had a few drinks. And he said, imagine if my wife was pregnant with a child that was gay. What mother would want a gay child? You would abort the child. And I said, I can't believe what you're saying. This is the most ridiculous thing in the world. Of all times, when the gay community feels free to really lead a free and independent life, to say this is absurd. Look what we would have lost if we would have limited all gay people from society, the amount of creativity that comes out of it. So I'm sure you, that guy would not be saying this today. This was about 7 or 8 years ago, because the things have changed so rapidly. So in the last decade, we've been seeing an acceptance, a major social change. I mean, now this discussion, I'm making this up, forgive me, the Episcopalians in the audience, I'm really making this up. Let me do it a rabbi. There's a discussion. Can you have a Jewish rabbi who's gay? To me, there's no problem. If he wants to be gay, let him be gay, as long as he gives a good sermon. I don't care. Yeah, but it wouldn't even be a discussion 30 years ago. So we've moved an enormous amount. So I think that just, education, talking to each other, changing the norms of society, you don't even need deep brain understanding. You just need a certain amount of civility and insight to do it. Obviously, when we get more brain understanding, what will we learn? There is a big conflict in the literature. I've never seen it as a conflict. My two buddies probably don't see it as a conflict. What is the nature of the homosexual brain? Is this an alteration in behavior that doesn't have an anatomical reflection, or is it developmentally determined? I am not a specialist in this, but I feel almost certain that, at least as far as men is concerned, I think with women there's a broader distribution, this is genetically determined, or at least it's determined by birth. If you ask most gay homosexuals, they say they felt different from the time they were very young. And I'm quite confident that we will identify anatomical differences in the brains of gay people that distinguish them from people who are not gay, homosexuals from heterosexuals. There's practically no doubt in my mind about that. Now, that will make it much easier for people who have trouble with it now, although they shouldn't, to understand what the nature is. There used to be a feeling when we came along in psychotherapy that this is an aberrant behavior and a little good analysis with a nice Jewish analyst and you're over that. It got nowhere. And now we understand why it got nowhere, because, these are fundamental anatomical changes. So I think that we will get insight in a lot of processes, but there is social progress of enormous kinds that can be made independent of that. And we've made it. We've been around for a long period of time as a people.
Great. Let's have... I'm lost. Get your hands up high, please. Okay. The gentleman right here on the end, and then we'll go to the woman further back there.
Yeah, hi. I'm having a great night. I'm really enjoying all the stimuli. Picked up your book today at the bookstore, and the other book stacked up like crazy next to yours is The Secret. It seems like everybody's talking about unconscious mind and mind power, pre-visualization. Do you have any opinion on this school of thought, which is mostly metaphysical?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of bullshit.
Did you have another question? Okay, we'll go about four rows further back there on the third seat from the end.
What makes certain information go into short-term memory and other into long-term memory, and can we control where we deposit it?
All information that ultimately goes into long-term memory, with very rare exception, goes through short-term memory. Okay? So it's very easy to form a short-term memory. You meet somebody at a cocktail party, they say their name is Barbara, you can repeat Barbara. The question is, will you remember it 2 hours later? Will you remember it the next day? That's the difference between short-term memory and long-term memory. What allows a short-term memory to be converted into long-term memory? In the simplest case, it's repetition. When you repeat something repeatedly, you know, you memorize a poem, Feskimowit in the Erde steht die Formos Lehm Rebrand, you know, little poems we learn as children. You repeat that and you remember it. You can remember it for the rest of your life, okay? So that's an important thing. Emotional charge. If something is exciting, if something is exhilarating, if something is frightening, you're likely to remember it for a long period of time. Your own state of mind. To remember something, particularly as you become older, you have to really focus your attention. Many elderly people who think they suffer from age-related memory loss, in addition to or instead of really suffer from the inability to focus attention, their mind wanders, so they don't concentrate as completely. So lots of factors determine whether you encode the information well enough to put it into long-term memory.
Okay. The gentleman here, then we're going to go all the way in the back, second row from the back. Sir, why don't you head on back so you can get to that quickly?
Since we've been talking about age-related memory loss, I have a...
I'm sorry, I don't see you.
He's right up here.
I'm sorry.
So you've done very exciting work on the molecular basis of age-related memory loss as compared to memory in normal adults. Has there been any similar work on memory in developmental stages in children? For example, their ability to acquire language with a facility that we adults can only marvel at.
Yeah. And this is not work that I ever had anything to do with, but there are lots of studies on this. First of all, it's been known for years that the ability to acquire a foreign language decreases with puberty, quite remarkably. You can acquire it, but you cannot require the accent for it. So I was 9 when I came here, and my brother was 14. He never quite lost a slight Viennese accent. My wife still has a French accent. Thank God. One knows that there is an area that is involved in the expression of speech called Broca's area, that if you learn a second language at the same time you learn the first language, so it's a bilingual home, that second language is represented in Broca's area. But if you learn it at a later time, it gets represented in a neighboring area. Part of the reason that happens is... that language acquisition later is problematical has been studied by a woman by the name of Patricia Kuhl at University of Washington in Seattle, who's shown that in early years, the brain has the capability to make all kinds of language distinctions. Now, I'm not going to get this right, but I'm just going to give you the idea. Japanese have a difficult time, I think, you should help me with this, distinguishing an L from an R. Kids don't have that difficulty. They can distinguish L from R, but Japanese kids lose that ability when they get to be about 3 or 4 years old. So learning a certain vocal relationship represses other vocal capabilities. So their whole set.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.